tonight on Arena. Fionn O'Rourke on her new version of The Lament of the Hag of Beara, and Malcolm Adams and Jeff O'Keefe on their new production of Tom McIntyre's The Gallant John Joe. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Woman of Winter by Fionn O'Rourke is a new version of The Lament of the Hag of Beara from the 9th century Irish. Fionn O'Rourke recognises the original as deeply engaged with how the world is to be experienced through the body, and specifically through the body of a woman whose social standing has been compromised as she has aged. Woman of Winter is a new poem written in contemporary English, and it draws upon the heritage of the original. Delighted to be joined by Fionn O'Rourke on the programme this evening. Maybe before we get stuck into what you've done with the poem, Fionn, talk to me a little bit about the original poem and what it was that attracted you to that old text.
Yeah, good evening, Sean. Well, I came across it when I was young, when I was about 18 or 19, and the version of it that I came across was Brendan Kennelly's. And I remember being really struck by it. And I think partly why I was struck by it was because I recognised even then that to come across a poem in the voice of an ageing or indeed old woman was a very unusual thing. And so it struck me and it stayed with me. And I've come across other translations since then, but I didn't feel like any of them had got it just quite right. There seems to be a great interest in having her be very repentant and having her turn to religion, and having her be kind of cowed by the fact that she's grown old, and an interest in having her become very quiet. And I wasn't interested in any of that. I thought,
surprise.
She's a resistant. Yeah. I thought, this is a resistant voice. This is a voice that's pushing back. This is a voice that's kind of sassy and that's hard and that's critical, as well as being kind of sensual and remembering the joy of being young and remembering the lovers and being desired and the gifts that they gave her and the success and the body and the hair and all of it. Remembering all of that with great kind of oomph, and not a bit ashamed of it and not a bit repentant, but regretful, I suppose, that it's gone from her, that that life has gone from her, but certainly not remorseful and in no way, I don't think, penitent. So I didn't want her, I was not sending her off to a nunnery at all. I was pulling her back from the nunnery and saying, you don't have to.
Yeah, no need to be quiet at all. But yes. It's interesting that you mentioned reading Brendan Kennelly's version of the poem in your late teens. I wondered, I know it's an anonymous, that's who it's ascribed to, or that is what it's ascribed to, in terms of we don't know who the writer was. But given what you're saying about this desire for repentance and this desire for her to turn to religion and this desire for her to be quiet, essentially, would you guess that it was written by a man or a woman?
It's actually quite hard to tell. I mean, we could say that most scribes in the 9th century were men, and mostly they were also, they had a religious context for themselves. So, all of this might lead us to read the poem in a certain way, but we don't know if that's the right way. There is one confusing thing, which is that she talks about a headdress, and most people have translated this as a veil, and therefore she becomes a nun. But in fact, I've been advised that it doesn't mean that. It actually means just a head covering. And that can be anything. I wear head coverings. You wear head coverings, I'm sure. So it doesn't, I don't think it signifies quite as much as people wanted it to signify. So there is that, I think, interest in having her be something that lines up with, it could be our social view of aging. It could be a religious view of aging, that it's a sort of a last chance to redeem yourself in some way, or to get on the right side of the books. And there's a little bit of that there. But I, you see, her voice, and the reason why I think it might have been a woman who wrote it, or somebody who knew women pretty well, is that there is this I think if a man was writing it, he would have wanted to punish her a little bit more for the life that she'd had, for the fact that she'd had a lot of lovers and that she enjoyed all of that very much. But there, you know, there is this coming through that says, I'm not sorry. I enjoyed it. I liked it. I wish I still had it. You know, so we can make all of that, make of that what we will. But I think that that tone is definitely there.
Yeah, there's no doubt in the version that you have given us at any rate that she had a very active life, shall we say, sexual and social life. She was much loved by many kings, it would seem. Is there a sense of this person, or this hag of Bera, going across generations, not being a real person but being something beyond that?
Yes, well, I mean, one of the versions we have of her puts her as being 7 centuries old. So clearly there's something going on that pushes us away from a literal reading of her. So it could be that she's a kind of a symbol of something. It could be that she's attached to the land in some way, that she's speaking for the land. So it's not clear exactly how we should interpret this figure. So I think that gives a little bit of license or leeway to someone like me to come along and say, well, you know, given that it's not absolutely clear and that we don't know who wrote it or exactly when or where it was written, except, you know, we think County Cork would be a good bet. Given all of that, I think there is a little bit of elbow room for someone like me to come along and say, well, look, I'll take what I can make of what's there, but I'll also write something of my own contemporary experience and the contemporary world into what has come to us from the 9th century, from the 11th, from the 16th century. And so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to use contemporary English, and I wanted to strip back all of these references to kind of medieval religion. Which we're not, I don't think I've, you know, desecrated it in any way or corrupted it in any way. I think they were a little flimsy anyway, just people wanted them to be there in some way. So I've kind of stepped away from all of that. And what I've tried to write is a plausible contemporary voice of a woman who has known her own body in very different circumstances, but who also knows it in her current circumstances. And she's not sort of speaking as a disembodied voice. Instead, she's speaking of a body and from a body, and it's still a sensual body because she still experiences the world sensually. You know, there is this sense of smell and sight and very rich description. So I think she still enjoys being in the body she's in to some extent, but she regrets that it's no longer young.
Yeah, although I am looking at a little section here where she's talking, she's referred to the fact that she sees girls brimful of May, but what is May to me? And she's talking about, does she regret that things have changed? Do I mind, she asks, a stanza further down. Oh, but that same hair had sun and moon in it once, when I used to be downing nights the way I down draughts of ale. So she was fond of a pint and a bit of crack of an evening.
Yeah, I think she suffers from something that a lot of us suffer from as we get older, which is this sense of, it was much better in my day. Oh, look at you, you've ruined it all now, you young people. So I think there's an element of that, but that I find that kind of charming, because I know this from my own world. I know this from people around me, from people both younger and older than I am. This sense of, oh, you young people, oh, you've got it all wrong.
There is a little bit of, I don't know if it's nostalgia or regret. Will you read a section for me? I think you'd chosen a section on page 19 that you might read for us, where we do get a sense that she's maybe realising she's not able to down all night and take the draughts of ale that she used to be able to do in this particular part.
I will. I'll read this. But also just to say, I think that's true. But I also think she's saying, well, what did you want me to be when I was young? Did you really want me to not be the person that I was and to use the body that I had? So I think, again, there's this resistance.
Yeah.
OK, I'll read it now. High days are gone under, and so too the low. What's left is a tidal wave of no days bearing down on me now. I spent my youth when I was young, and what else would I do? Had I worn it, vestal, close into me, would it have worn more gently? It's not as if it were preserves to be lardered or put up on my own high shelf for taking down in winter, though God knows I tried that too, for all the good it did me. It slipped clean through my grasp, my youth, as seawater through sand.
touch. That's Fiona O'Rourke reading from Woman of Winter, her version of The Hag of Berra, The Lament of the Hag of Berra. There's a touch of there in that final line that you read for us, Fiona. It slipped green through my grasp, my youth as seawater through sand. Youth is wasted on the youth. There's a bit of that in there, isn't there?
There is, and also, by God, how fast it goes.
Yeah.
And when you're in it, when you're in your youth, you think it's going to last forever, and then suddenly it's the rear view mirror and you're going, whoa, what happened there?
Yeah, because I was wondering when you said that you first read it, you know, at 18 or 19, had you any sense of, you know, what's this old hag? What's she giving out about getting old? So that's miles off.
Yeah, oh, definitely, definitely that. But I think just that, you know, there is another way in which the hag has aged, which is like, you know, it was written in the 9th century. So it is now, like, how many centuries ago is that? And still we have it. And still we have it in versions that were recorded in the 16th century that were copied. And we have it in the National Library in manuscript form from the 16th century. So this sense of this voice somehow abiding, I mean, that is extraordinary. Whoever the voice was, whoever it belonged to, whatever kind of body it belonged to, it is extraordinary that the poem still exists and that it is available to the likes of me to read and to study and to write into, in a way.
Yeah, and I wondered about that. I mean, I said at before the Nuacht, I talked about a translation, but I changed my mind when I was getting to the top of the programme and I talked about your version of the poem rather than your translation of the poem. Is version a better way of putting it? I don't think you've taken kind of stanza by stanza and tried to rework the lines in any way. It's more that you're getting the flavour of what she says in the lament. Would that be fairer? Would that be a fair way of describing it?
I think it is a fairer way. I'm not a 9th century Irish scholar. I'm not a medieval Irish person at all, or pre-medieval. As a contemporary poet, and there's something about the tone of this poem that just kind of grabbed me. And I think it's immensely interesting, this way of looking at the past that allows it to be what it was, that isn't translating it into some other version of what happened, but that still makes it tally against current conditions. So the tone of it, I think, is really important. Sometimes it's rueful, sometimes it's celebratory, sometimes it's very cross, which I like too, because crossness is not something you enter all that much in poetry, just sheer crossness about how dare this happen to me and what the hell, basically. So all of that tonal stuff was very important. So I think as much as anything, I wrote into the tone of what I had.
And I guess I know it's always dangerous to mix up the poetic eye with the eye of the poet, as it were. But I wonder to what extent did you find that the voice of Fiona O'Rourke agreed with a lot of what the Hag of Berra had to say?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say I disagree with her. but I have to say, you know, I mean, it's not the same now. It's not wonderful to be a middle-aged woman, you know, and looking at the future. It's, you know, there's a lot of things that still remain to be dealt with and to be resolved. But I have to say, I think things are a little better in that at least I can support myself and I'm not dependent on other people to leave me alms or to give me shelter or so on. I am independent and nobody is requiring me to be some kind of absolutely pale, thinned down version of what I was 30 years ago. So I think, you know, I want that to be in the poem as well. I don't want it to be just a totally cowed, subdued, repentant person. I want there to be something of the fact that my circumstances are different to hers and my solitude is different to her solitude and my old age will be different to hers as well. But there are also connections. There are differences, but there are connections.
But did that make you, did writing the poem and doing your version of the poem, did you see the aging process for yourself or did you see the aging process differently after having dealt with this poem?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I never really thought about that. I wonder have I... I mean, obviously, I kind of have drawn on my own sense of what it means to grow older and the pluses, because there are some pluses. I don't think she had many pluses,
yeah,
except maybe the freedom to go out and engage with nature. But other than that, probably not a lot. But there are pluses to it in my life, but there are definite negatives to it as well. I don't know if poetry feeds back in that way into the life, if poetry can fix things in the life. Hmm. That's a nice thought, though. I will hold on to that for a little bit. Perhaps that might be possible, John.
One other thing I did want to mention are the illustrations by Isabel Nolan within the book. Several of them stood out for me. Indeed, in that section that I read about the Downing Knights and the way I downed Raftvale, wonderful illustration. It's like a pencil illustration or an ink illustration of what looks to me like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, almost the 5 ages of woman, from, you know, the young girl, maybe teenage girl, up to the older woman as that circle of women goes around. Tell me a little bit about your involvement with Isabel in these illustrations.
Well, I approached Isabel and asked her would she have any interest in doing this, and it turns out that Isabel has been working with medieval manuscripts herself and actually knows a great deal more than I do about them. So she sort of hit the ground running with it and came up with various drawings that are themselves kind of translations of other drawings that exist in medieval manuscripts. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just ingenious. I mean, they're gorgeous and they're very, very interesting and the detail is very impressive. But this idea that she's translating from images that already exist, but like me, putting a more contemporary spin on them, or drawing in a way that the same images or similar images would not have been drawn. So that it's a stylistic in interpretation or change. And I thought that was just so intelligent and so brilliant, and I think her drawings add such great luster, really, and interest and depth to the book. I'm immensely honoured to have them here. They're gorgeous things.
Yeah, the book itself is a beautiful item in and of itself, never mind the words and the illustrations inside. Just the feel of it and the look of it is beautiful, I think. Just have one final question before I get you to read a final section for me, Vona. The fact that this poem has been handed down from the 9th century through several versions, through several generations, this voice of a woman, that Ireland has brought that poetry to us. What does that say, if anything?
Well, it's very important. I mean, you know, we're used to voices that are men's voices, and very often we know exactly, well, not exactly, but we have a sense, especially with, you know, the glosses in the monastic manuscripts and so on. We have a sense that obviously they were men who made those poems, and this one is a little sort of at a tangent to that, because it's not resolved in the way that sometimes poems that are written of the moment, like those gorgeous monastic glosses, are. And they're resolved. They're a single thought at a single moment, and they're perfected, if you like. And this is a little bit messier than that. It sort of weaves in and out of itself. And I think, you know, in terms of contemporary poetry, it's a very good model for not trapping yourself in a single tone, in a single thought, in a single form, for allowing something more sinuous and fluid, and even sometimes self-contradictory, to come through. And I think that's very useful. It's not just the subject matter that is unusual. I think the form of the poem is also quite unusual and very useful, I think, for contemporary work.
I suppose, if I might say, to allow the tide to come in and go out, which is kind of where this second section that you're going to read for us, it talks about that kind of aspect of things, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
So maybe you'd read that. Do you want to give us a little lead into it, or are you happy just to go into it, Fiona?
I'll just go in for, just head straight on into it. It's towards the end of the lament. In with vigour, out with slump is the way of tides, as I know well, who tried to hold back time and tide and opened bone dry palms. On the in, no end of lovers and love. On the out, no sign of either. On the in, full surge of time. On the out, these driftwood hours, for the flood of all the world's goings on stops shy of my privacy in its cramped, parched room and unlifted latch, where no one comes and no one goes who had sight of my heyday, and no one comes and no one goes who saw me brimful of May, who ate and drank his fill and more. Forever was I known by a light hand to flick darkness to candles and song. But the same dark, or another, drowned them all.
Fiona O'Groke reading from her poem, Woman of Winter, a version of The Lament of the Hag of Berwick. Great to speak with you as always, Fiona. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks, John.
That's Fiona O'Groke. And Woman of Winter is published by Gallery Press. Actor Malcolm Adams and director Jeff O'Keefe have teamed up to revive The Gallant John Joe, an award-winning play from Tom McIntyre, which was first produced back in 2001. The original show featured an iconic performance by actor Tom Hickey, who worked closely with the playwright in developing the character, an ageing Lear-like figure railing in lyrical torrents against the fading light of day as his body and perhaps his mind are failing him. This new production is the first revival since then, so it might be fair to say that the pressure is on. Delighted to have Malcolm Adams and Jeff O'Keefe with me in studio. I'm sure you're very happy for me to mention Tom McIntyre, revival of an award-winning play, and Tom Hickey within a few sentences of each other. Had you seen that original production, or were you aware of it, Malcolm?
I was aware of it, but I didn't see it. But I did Tom McIntyre's last produced play, Only in Apple. Mm. And I found myself in, I suppose, resonance with him and his writing, and what I maybe rightly or wrongly describe a kind of a magical realism, that area of the Irish psyche that is in between kind of reality and magic. Mm. And he likes to explore that area, and I found myself compelled by that and drawn to that. So when Jeff made a suggestion of a number of plays, and this was one of the plays he suggested, I just jumped at it. I'm like going, and you know, it's like I jumped before I looked.
Yeah. Said yes and then thought.
Yeah, and then thought, oh, okay, this could be a bit of a challenge. But I think I have that, it's an element of a moth to the flame kind of a thing, you know, where you kind of go towards
Well, hopefully not the thing that'll burn you up.
Not the thing that'll burn you up completely. You're always going to get a little bit burned, but not completely. But yeah, drawn towards that challenge in a way.
What attracted you to the play?
Well,
Jeff?
Interestingly enough as well, like Mal, I hadn't seen the play, but I had seen Mal in Only in Apple, and I was familiar with Tom's work and from Cavan myself. So that was kind of an immediate connection for me. But I was drawn to the fact that it was this kind of iconic piece of theatre, and his work, the work of Tom McIntyre, you know, although he himself would have said that he didn't influence Irish theatre in any way. But I mean, I think he's inspired so many people, you know. So it always felt like I needed to look at a piece, and this was the right fit. Myself and Mal, who'd worked with us in the Mill Theatre, Mal played Polonius in Hamlet, and myself and himself and Kate Canning, the artistic director, we sat down, and this is one of the plays that come up. And when I mentioned this play, his eyes lit up, and I said, "He's the man to do it. I know he has something that he can bring to it." And I feel drawn to it. You know, I feel that this story needs to be told again. You know. And the fact that we haven't, that neither of us had seen the original production, I think that's actually a really good thing.
Possibly, because it would loom large if you had seen
it. It would be so intimidating. Yeah. Yeah. I think I probably wouldn't have considered it.
You'd run away.
Yeah. I saw Tom Hickey in the Sons of Ulster March Towards the Somme 40 years ago, and he just blew me away. Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, particularly his work with Tom McIntyre, not just the Gallant John Joe, but right across the several plays. Most famously, I guess, The Great Hunger.
Yeah.
Not a Cavan play, but a Monaghan play, you could argue. the Tom McIntyre, Patrick Mason and Tom Hickey version, that kind of visual theatre that they gave us, and that was something quite extraordinary, no question about that. But The Gallant John Joe, John Joe Cuncannon, how would you describe him? Where is he at? Because it's just you telling us this story, Malcolm.
Yes. I think we encounter him first, and whether he's in sound mind and body is a question that even he asks throughout the play. And he discovers his daughter is pregnant, his young daughter, she's 16 maybe. And some people might say old-fashionedly, he decides that he needs to find out who the father is. And he goes through a succession of suspects. And he's not happy, to say the least, but also it's to do with his relationship with his daughter, Jacinta, who is quite flippant about the whole thing, we'll say, and resistant to any of his questioning. So their relationship is quite fractious in a way. So a lot of the anguish, I suppose, he has is more to do with his relationship with his daughter. Mm-hmm. The wife is dead and whatever. So it's just him and his daughter, and he's the primary care or something. And he has this wonderful section where he talks about, I'm the person who's responsible, you know, down the lane, you know, I'm the one blamed for not taking charge and the harm done.
Yes.
Which I think is, to me, is extraordinary in the sense of it is about, for in his mind, parental responsibility in that way. And at the same time, in a very Irish way, I guess with McIntyre, for me, the Irish psyche has to do, it's a yin and a yang kind of thing, you know, I'm a hero, I'm a villain at the same time. And he hates himself and he blames himself and he throws himself down and he invites scorn and he invites, you know, the
absolutely. And he's certainly I think, Jeff, it's safe to say he's not too fond of, as Malcolm referred to them, the suspects who might have been involved, the other half of the pregnancy, if you like. What kind of a community does he paint for us, McIntyre? Because it is a recognisable calvin, but it's a kind of a. It's ramped up a little, isn't it, in many ways?
I think so. You know, it becomes heightened. It becomes sort of theatrical, you know, in his use of language, where language sometimes is more about the sound rather than the meaning behind the words, you know. He paints vivid images for us. But yet within that, there's still, you know, there's aspects of John Joe I recognise. I recognise men in Cavan. I probably knew them. To know that they were like John Joe, so he comes in some way. He comes from maybe an older tradition, but they're still out there. The John Joes.
Did you recognise people like as John Joe calls him, the hypnotist,
yeah.
as opposed to the hypnotist, and the owner of the local Chinese, who he simply refers to as the Chinese.
And there's
Bossman. These are big male characters from that neck of the woods.
Yeah, no, for sure. He paints them vividly, and again, kind of like the what I love about the writing is that they're inhabited in one. In one viewpoint, they're inhabited in the viewpoint of John Joe, you know. So we experience their world through his eyes and through his versions of events, whether they're real or not. And that's sort of exciting.
You might read or perform a little section for us, Malcolm. This is a little bit into the play. Will you give us a bit of context here? What stage are we at in his investigations into the pregnancy?
Well, he's after identifying two suspects, and the hypnotist is one of them, actually. But Jacinta comes back. She's gone out and she kind of disappeared for a while, and she's come back. And as I said, they've had this fractious relationship. And she's been quite dismissive of him, you know, and kind of the usual teenage kind of, you know, get out of my hair kind of thing. But she finds out certain things about him. And she has this wonderful line, which I'll read and then I'll go into the bit. And she says, "There's no one going nowhere out of this place. Minding each other is our business, and we'll meet that obligation." And to me, that encapsulates the whole thing.
Yeah, minding each other is our business.
Minding each other is our business. So will I go through it?
Yeah.
"I just sat there. I didn't know what to say or do. She gives me another hug, and I starts crying. And then she makes a sup of tea, and we starts gossiping the way we used to before the war was a time-tethered meet to Husky Ground. 'Mind the time,' says she. 'You had the pointer and receiver.' 'Aye,' says I. 'Bran and Smokey with the gammy leg.' And there she is racing around the place pretending she's Bran and Smokey like she used to when she was knee-high to a grasshopper. And laughing and talking about those days. And Uncle Shah and Mickey the Pound. 'Poor Uncle Shah,' says she. 'What age would he be now?'
top in the 90s, says I. Walked into the lake in the middle of the night. Huh. Wanted to see how deep it was, I suppose. Oh, like old times it was. Old times. And the hay saved. I sat back. If it was a Siamese, I'd a port.
That's Malcolm Adams with a section there from the Gallant John Joe new production directed by Jeff O'Keefe is what Malcolm and Jeff are speaking to me about this evening, a famous Tom McIntyre play, the Gallant John Joe. There's a really moving quality to that relationship that,
yes.
that Malcolm is building there, Jeff. Is that yeah. something that you discovered as you went through the script? Because it's a very controlling relationship in one way, but it's also... You can see where he's coming from.
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a huge amount of tenderness in this man. And on many levels, when we read him first, he may not be someone we particularly like, and some of his views we might be a bit repelled by them. But there's a humanity in him.
Mm.
Do you know? There's a need for love. There's a need to have peace of mind. There's a need to feel okay in the world, and there's a fear. But what I think McIntyre does so brilliantly is he brings us from those moments into hate, into moments of just pure tenderness, and they just they come out of nowhere. They're magicked up. Mm. That's what McIntyre does so successfully. He brings magic into this piece. He fills it with ghosts and memories and wisps and hallucinations, and there's tenderness in that.
Yeah, there is real tenderness, particularly in that section that you did for Malcolm. But the title, The Gallant John Joe, we might think is John Joe Concannon, your character.
Right.
But in fact, The Gallant John Joe is the Cavan footballer.
Yes, John Joe O'Reilly.
John Joe O'Reilly.
Yes.
Famous for, he tells us this, doesn't he,
yes.
in the midst of the play, why John Joe O'Reilly is so well known?
Well, he won the All-Ireland for Cavan.
Yeah, in New York.
Yes, in New York.
I think the only winner,
the only
man to captain an All-Ireland winning team in New York.
That's right.
So what way does he fit into, I suppose in some ways what McIntyre is doing there, he's opening up that sense of community to us, isn't he?
Yes, and also there's actually a more personal, more specific thing going on apart from kind of the cabin connection of John Joe O'Reilly. Jacinta at some point says, she goes, I believe, Pa, that everybody has a song. And the trick, if you can learn it, is to sing it, Pa. And then you're floating. And then you're flying. So in my sense, the song of John Joe O'Reilly...
Because the Gallant John Joe is from that song.
It's from the song.
The song about John Joe O'Reilly.
And I, in my head then, this is the song that John Joe Concannon sings to himself or says to himself over. It's like an affirmation. It's like a mantra. So it's the John Joe O'Reilly, which is the hero, the great footballer, the great man. He was everything that John Joe Concannon is not.
Yeah.
And it's like all our heroes, we want to be like them, but we see how far below we fall. And so you mentioned Lear early on. And in a sense, there is a tragic element to him because of that.
Yeah, and the play opens in the Mill Theatre in Dundrum, as you said, Jeff, and then it goes to Cavan.
Yeah.
That is quite the task, I would have thought, to bring it to its home place and your own home place.
Yeah, but it's really exciting.
Yes.
You know, it's it feels right. It feels, you know, the time is good. You know, since Tom McIntyre sadly passed away, I just would hate to think that the legacy of this man becomes a bit forgotten, do you know?
And indeed, I suppose we should, Tom McIntyre's a few years back, but Tom Hickey as well is only 2 years ago
of
now
course.
At this stage as well, since he died.
Yeah, of course. So it feels right and it feels exciting to be in that new space in Cavan.
And
very much looking forward
McIntyre
to it.
McIntyre was very interested in no relation, by the way.
Yes. You know, Pádraig McIntyre is no relation to Tom McIntyre, but he is very close
keen
to
it.
Keenan, you're bringing it up there.
Yeah, for sure.
Finally, I put you under pressure earlier on, Malcolm, by saying it's fair to say that the pressure is on. What kind of pressure is it when it is just you? Because it is. We were talking to Fionn O'Gorka about the Hag of Erin and the great female monologue that poem is.
Right.
This is one of the great male monologues
from
much more recent time.
Yeah.
How daunting a prospect is it being out there by yourself in that fashion on stage?
Yeah, I mean, it is a huge challenge, and it's kind of terrifying at one level. But at another level, that's quite interesting as well, because that motivates you. You know, that brings up a lot of emotion about it. And also, it is, I like that form in the sense of just the storyteller. Mm. You know what I mean? And it's like it's just one voice, but it's like we're seeing kind of all the other characters through his perspective. So that's quite interesting as well. And also there's an element to the play. There's a very physical element to the play that...
Well, it wouldn't be McIntyre if there wasn't.
Mm. Exactly. What did he call it? The gestural...
Gestural scores.
Gestural scores. That. Yeah. So we're bringing some elements of...
Is he very specific in the stage directions as to what those gestures are?
He is and he isn't. It's really interesting. He's very eloquent in how he describes them, but he never really... Like, when I was working with him, he would never really tell you what he meant.
So you had to find out. Is there one in the script, maybe a kind of a poetic description? Because he wouldn't say he points to the ceiling or he puts his hands up into the air. It wouldn't be as direct as that.
He simmers on the liquid slopes of Golgotha.
He simmers on the liquid slopes of Golgotha. So that's a stage direction for you, yeah.
He spins into a gestural score of showing the ball to an opponent, then whipping it away, impotent tease and reprise of that.
Yeah, so he's kind of giving you...
So he suggests something and then he allows you enough room then to create something yourself. So we're going to bring some guy into it, I think.
I think what Malcolm really does is he tunes into Tom McIntyre's, I suppose, idiom in so much that he uses lots of different languages to tell stories. So it's not just the word, it's the image. Yeah.
Well,
it's the physical.
Again, wouldn't be McIntyre if there wasn't physical and if there wasn't image involved. Yeah. The Gallant John Joe is the title of the play, new production by, it's the play by Tom McIntyre, new production directed by Jeff O'Keefe with Malcolm Adams in the title role of the Gallant John Joe, kind of the title role of the Gallant John Joe. It's at the DLR Mill Theatre in Dundrum from the 21st through until the 30th of September. Then it goes to the Town Hall in Cavan from the 4th through until the 6th of October. And you can find out full details at milltheatre.ie and townhallcavan.com. Fidget Feet, the aerial dance company, have teamed up with traditional music company Kyol Connected to create a new show for young audiences called When the Moon Spun Round. The music for the show is composed by Piper Thomas Johnson. I'm delighted that Thomas is with me in studio this evening. Your part, Fidget Feet is the aerial dance company, is the other company involved in this, Thomas, but you are Kyol Connected. Tell me a little bit about your company and how yourself and Fidget Feet came together.
Yeah, so Kyol, for most of your listeners, will know that Kyol is the Irish word for music. So Kyol Connected, I set up Kyol Connected 12 years ago this year, which is incredible. So at the heart of Kyol Connected is the creation of gig theatre experiences for very young children. So we bring together wonderful musicians, singers, dancers, but also artists from across a whole range of other art forms, so puppeteers, visual artists, theatre makers, to really create beautiful, engaging experiences for children.
And when you say gig theatre, you mean something that has aspects of theatre like the traditional play, but it also has particularly music and all those other art forms in there?
Yeah, gig theatre is, I suppose, what I've become most comfortable with, because we do at the heart of the shows that Kyol Connected creates is a band essentially, but then we work with directors and script writers to create the stories that maybe weave through a show. So gig theatre is that place, I think, between a music performance and a theatre for young audience.
It's kind of the best of both. And the two things added, I would guess you would say, add into something bigger than either separate thing.
Yeah, well, let's go with that. So you asked about Kyol Connected and
Fidget Feet. Yeah, how did that collaboration come about?
So January 2020, before the sort of world
all went wrong,
took a turn. Myself and Chantel, who's the artistic director of Fidget Feet.
Yeah, Chantel McCormick.
Chantel, who I think you've spoken to before.
Yes, yeah.
We went with a delegation of other artists and creatives and directors from the world of theatre for young audiences over to a showcase event in Philadelphia with a Culture Ireland delegation over to IPAY, which is the International Performing Arts for Youth Conference. So we all went over there. There was a focus in Ireland that year, and we went over there to pitch our wares, basically to say, this is who we are. Come talk to us, collaborate with us. We'd love to tour our work in North America. We'd love to create new partnerships and collaborations. And we all, I think we had a 3-minute pitch each, you know, that we had nailed down to a T. And after my pitch and Chantelle from Fidget Feet's pitch, we looked at each other and we were like, how have we not worked together before?
Were the pitches similar, or did you just resonate with each other? What was it about her pitch that made you think, why are we not working together?
I think there was just, I think we both saw that potential for a synergy between the two companies. Mm. I think what inspires us in terms of the integrity of our work, in terms of our intentions for our work. I think Chantelle and Fidget Feet wanted to connect over a little more with the traditional arts in terms of Kjol Connected. We're always looking for collaborations across other art forms. That's sort of what drives us as well. So what happens in those spaces between traditional music and theatre, or traditional music and visual arts, and in this case, traditional music and aerial dance.
Aerial dance. When the Moon Spun Round is a great title. Wonderful piece of poetic writing there, coming from W.B. Yeats, I believe.
It is, yeah, yeah. So some of Fidget Feet's previous shows were very much inspired by W.B. Yeats' poetry. In fact, after January 2020, when we couldn't move ahead to create our indoor show, we Fidget Feet created an outdoor show called A Handful of Dreams, again inspired by W.B. Yeats' The Stolen Child. And myself and Jim Daly co-wrote the music for that. So that was a tester for, can we all work together? Which we could. So then moving on to create our new show, we were very much, again, drawn to that work. And I loved that invitation for me to explore W.B. Yeats's.
And what exactly is the W.B. Yeats? Is it a set of stories for children? Is it a single story, that book, When the World Spun Round?
Yeah,
you have it there with you.
I have it here. So Chantelle actually discovered the book in a bookshop in Sligo. It called out to her in these months that we were trying to figure out what her show would become. And it's a beautifully illustrated book edited by Noreen Doody and illustrated by Shona Shirley MacDonald, called The Moon Spun Round, W.B. Yeats for Children. So this has been our Bible.
Is it stories? Is it poems? Or what is it?
It's a collection of poems and stories that have really inspired what our show has become. So in the very early days, myself, Chantelle, all of the other artists and creatives and tech team sat around in the Irish Aerial Creation Centre with this book. We read the stories, we read the poems, we discussed them, we spoke about what we responded to, and eventually we sort of whittled it down to 4 or 5 poems that really spoke to us. Yeah.
It was like a wave of the sea, one of those poems.
Yes, that's one of the poems.
I'm glad it is.
And the Cat and the Moon is another one.
Yeah. Well, I'm playing Like a Wave of the Sea, which is one of the pieces of music. These are your compositions, are they?
I worked with Fidget Feet's Jim Daly to co-create the music, and then a wonderful team including Niamh Dunn, fiddle player, Tara Dunn, not related, fiddle player, Sean O'Graham, Stephen Markham created a beautiful sound design. We worked also with Trevor Hutchinson, so it's been the music has been a really collaborative process as well.
And I think there's a whistle in this. Is it you on the whistle?
That's me.
Oh,
That's just a little bit of the music that goes with Like a Wave of the Sea, which is part of the Fidget Feet and Kjole Connected show When the Moon Spun Round, and the musical part of that particular collaboration. Thomas Johnson of Kjole Connected is with me in studio this evening. So I'm guessing, Thomas, it's not a story per se. It doesn't have a beginning and middle and an end. It's more about the visuals of the aerial spectacle that Fidget Feet can give us, and the music melding in with that.
Yeah, it doesn't have that traditional story arc that you might have in a theatre piece. It's almost more of an unfolding experience where we would invite children into this magical world of wonder and curiosity. So it's more of a journey through the piece where I suppose there's a lot of different experiences for the children to connect with.
Do we hear the words of Yeats in the midst of it all, or does it depend on the music and the aerial spectacle rather than the words?
Yeah, there's one scene. It's really playful. It's called. It's inspired by the Cat and the Moon poem, and that's a whole scene where we have a quite sort of vibrant, slightly bonkers, really playful cat scene where there's beautifully choreographed cats swinging and dancing on trapezes, and myself and the other musician are also flying, I have to say, up in that trapeze. So as part of that scene, we do hear the words of W.B. Yeats, and also Jim Daly responded to W.B. Yeats to create some poetry that we also hear in the show.
I wondered about whether you were going to be on the trapeze or not, and whether you were going to be part of the flying thing, because you're playing whistle in that, but most of the time, or certainly in the track that I'm about to play, you're playing the illan pipes. How on earth do you do that, or do you take an easy route when you're up on the... Are you playing when you're up there?
I am, yeah.
Illan pipes?
I'm playing my whistle when I'm flying.
Even that's quite the task, I would have thought.
I'm on solid ground when I'm playing the illan pipes, but for that particular scene, I'm flying on the trapeze. I did have my first experience of flying and playing in the previous show, A Handful of Dreams, and I was playing the pipes then.
How difficult a task is that?
Very securely strapped in. I think what excited Chantal, I'm speaking for Chantal here, was the opportunity to direct musicians in movement and to bring that world of musicians and aerialists together. So I sort of come in with one foot in theatre in my work. I really love that, and I love the challenge of that as well.
Tell me a little bit about, this is purely a pipe tune that I want to finish up with. Tell me a little bit about Waltz of the Half-Life. I just love this tune, I have to say. And there's kind of a sadness in it. Am I right in thinking that?
There is, yeah. The melody of Waltz of the Half-Life is a continuation of the opening scene of the show, which is a very dreamlike, a dreamlike piece. Which sort of captures a moonscape where the aerialists are flying and floating. So we continued with that melody, and I suppose it's a very there is a sadness to it, but sort of there's a joy in there as well.
Within the sadness, as well. It's Waltz of the Half-Light, is it?
Waltz of the Half-Light.
So that's Waltz of the Half-Light, part of the music from Fidget Feet and Kjole Connected's show When the Moon Spun Around. And just as we were listening to that, Thomas Johnson, you were talking about how much you're enjoying. You're kind of getting goosebumps thinking about the collaboration.
I was, yeah, I really was. I think in When the Moon Spun Around, there's such heart in the piece. There really, really is. And the collaboration has been such a coming together of two families, and we've been so honest in the process with each other, and we've taken risks, and we've really put everything into trying to create something beautiful.
If you're flying in the air and playing the whistle or the pipes, I don't care which it is, you're certainly taking risks. Thanks so much for coming into us this evening, Thomas. That's Thomas Johnson. And When the Moon Spun Round plays Dreacht, suitably enough, magic, Dreacht in Blanchardstown on the 22nd and 23rd of September. And then it tours from various venues, from Galway to Donegal and further afoot as well. Fidgetfeet.com will give you all of the details on those dates and venues. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched this evening. The broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Ashling Grufferty was on sound, and tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1, and Féachana Ó Breanáin will be with you. Tá éis na nuachta.